Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the imminent ruling by a St. Louis County grand jury about whether to indict Darren Wilson, the police officer who killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, has media focused on the possibility of violent demonstrations. But the issues raised by Brown's killing won't disappear, no matter what the jury decides. We'll talk with educator and organizer Maryam Kaba about the bigger story. Also this week, the White House's climate emissions deal with China was praised throughout the media as a big step in the right direction. One liberal columnist told readers not to listen to the "yes, but" naysayers. But critics of the deal are worth listening to. We'll speak with one, Daphne Weisham of the Center for Sustainable Economy. All that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Congressional efforts to pass a bill authorizing construction of the Keystone XL pipeline brought that issue back into the news, which meant the return of some of the same old misinformation. One NPR report told listeners that Republicans see Keystone as a great job creator and a boost for North American energy independence, while opponents argue that it develops remote and low-grade sources of energy. That's not really the debate, though. Critics point out that it will create very few long-term jobs, it means nothing for so-called energy independence, and it will dump millions of tons of carbon into the atmosphere. But misleading frameworks for discussing Keystone were common. ABC This Week put the question this way, quote, "Will it really create thousands of American jobs and lower the price you pay at the pump?" Close quote. To sort that out, ABC turned to Russ Girling, who happens to be the CEO of TransCanada, the company that wants to build Keystone. He claimed the pipeline would create 42,000 enduring jobs, a claim that was scored false by the fact-checkers at PolitiFact. Elsewhere on the Sunday chat show circuit, things weren't much better. NBC's Meet the Press turned the Keystone debate over to roundtable guests Chris Matthews and former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina. Matthews said Keystone was going to happen because the country wants jobs, a point that Fiorina enthusiastically endorsed. Host Chuck Todd did tell viewers that on Meet the Press's website, there was a Keystone debate they could watch. Apparently, that's not the kind of thing you put on TV.
The New York Times sure sounds as though there's cause for celebration with their November 17th story, "Mega Mergers Popular Again on Wall Street." 5 years after the end of the financial crisis that reshaped the economy, it appears that big companies are finally willing to make big bets again, the story proclaims. Though the claim is ubiquitous in business reporting, many readers still probably marvel that the financial crisis is long over, given that their own crisis is not, stagnant wages and reduced benefits being just some of the ways the economy has been reshaped. But it's easy to feel that the Times thinks a rise in mega mergers means just what the story's most prominent source, Mark Zandi from Moody's, says it does. Quote, "It reflects the economy, and it also portends better times ahead. Deals don't get done unless people feel pretty good about the future." Close quote. Ah, but which people, exactly? Does the fact that CEOs are feeling pretty good about things, as the story says, mean that the majority of U.S. households, which rely on paychecks, should feel good too? Not at all. And the paper knows it, though it's several graphs along before an intimation emerges about, quote, "some dark corners in the dazzling successes of Wall Street's dealmakers," close quote. Because while they're spending on acquisitions, quote, "wage growth remains sluggish and hiring is growing only modestly," close quote. As economist Richard Wolff noted recently, from 2007, the last year before the current recession hit, until now, the median income of Americans has dropped by nearly 10%, with no recovery evident. That's not a dark corner. That's most of the room.
Sometimes the questions reporters pose reveal a lot about their worldview. Here's ABC's Cecilia Vega on November 16th after a report of another beheading by ISIS in Syria.
These numbers, they're absolutely staggering. About 800 airstrikes so far against ISIS. Why isn't this working?
Of course, the assumption here is that dropping bombs should and does work. But anyone who's paid attention to Iraq, Afghanistan, or Libya might understand that war isn't a type of magic that delivers instant, positive results. Or consider a November 18th chat between PBS NewsHour correspondent Margaret Warner and a U.S. Treasury official, where she muses about bombing ISIS-controlled oil facilities.
These are essentially fixed assets, the oil fields they've taken over, the refineries they've taken over in Iraq and Syria. Why can't you just bomb them out completely?
Her guest dodges the issue, since selecting bombing targets isn't actually his job. But it's revealing that what popped into her mind was how easy it might be to just blow up whatever is thought to belong to ISIS. There is more careful journalism about the war that might help explain why this worldview is so off. A November 14th story in the New York Times, for instance, explained that some residents of one city in Syria were opposed to U.S. bombing because it was making things there worse. The Times notes that one of the targets for U.S. attacks was an oil refinery said to be under control of ISIS. The attack killed the 10 civilians who worked there. That is the reality of war, and it's a far cry from the way some TV reporters imagine U.S. wars work.
NPR host Scott Simon took a virtual victory lap after his interview with Bill Cosby, which, according to Vanity Fair, concluded, quote, by asking him directly about the allegations that he had sexually assaulted and/or drugged more than a dozen women, close quote. Simon says it's all part of the job of tough journalism. I've covered 10 wars, he explained. I just did what I should. Well, here's the problem with the story of Simon asking Bill Cosby about rape allegations, as Salon put it. He didn't.
This question gives me no pleasure, Mr. Cosby, but there have been serious allegations raised about you in recent days. You're shaking your head no. I'm in the news business. I have to ask the question. Do you have any response to those charges? Shaking your head no. There are people who love you who might like to hear from you about this. I want to give you the chance. All right.
With no response from his guest, Simon wrapped up the interview. It may seem a minor point, but in a society that still doesn't want to acknowledge the prevalence of sexual assault, it's significant that what's being called Simon's rape question doesn't include the word rape. The most specific it gets is serious allegations. Bill Cosby certainly knew what Simon was talking about, as did the media writers who reported on the interview and gave Simon credit for bringing it up. But listeners unaware of the substance of the allegations would have no idea. That's not how news reporting is supposed to work.
And finally, on the November 16th edition of Face the Nation, host Bob Schieffer had this to say to one of his guests, Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill.
Let me ask you this. Elizabeth Warren, the fiery populist from Massachusetts, has now been part of voted in as part of the leadership in the Senate. How do you feel about that? It's another woman in leadership, but is this going to leave the impression that the party is moving to the left when a lot of people think the only way that you can get anything done is if both parties move toward the center?
Setting aside the stale, you're a woman and this other person is also a woman approach, as we've said many times, it's mainly journalists and pundits and not a lot of people who insist, no matter what, that Democrats should move to the center. But think about that idea in the context of this particular program. The first guest on Face the Nation was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who slammed Obama from the right on Iran. The next guest was Mitt Romney, who criticized Obama from the right on foreign and domestic policy. Then came McCaskill, who is one of these centrist Democrats who don't want to have much to do with Barack Obama. The next interview was with Tea Party Republican Senator Mike Lee, who was not questioned about the need to move the Republican Party to the middle. This roster of Republican and right-leaning guests is par for the course for Schieffer's show, which raises the question— when will Face the Nation move toward the center?
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Gun sales surge ahead of jury's Ferguson decision, is the headline on a November 19th AP story, which leads with one gun store owner's comment that, quote, police aren't going to be able to protect every single individual. If you don't prepare yourself and get ready for the worst, you have no one to blame but yourself, close quote. Stories like that play a big role in creating and shaping the public's understanding of future events in Ferguson, Missouri, and elsewhere, as a St. Louis County grand jury is expected to decide soon whether to indict police officer Darren Wilson for the killing of Michael Brown. This focus, overwhelmingly not on whether protesters will be violent, but just on how violent, sidesteps the role of militarized policing as itself a source of tension and trouble. But it also misses a key fact that protesters have tried to make, that this whole story is just a part of a world of violence brought to bear on the lives of Black people in Ferguson and around the country. Over-policing, racial profiling, funding police departments with low-level warrants, over-incarceration, the school-to-prison pipeline. These things won't disappear, even if Darren Wilson goes to jail. So how do we keep those issues front and center while media virtually pop popcorn and pull up seats for a big fight? Maryam Kaba is a social justice educator and organizer. She's founding director of Project NEA, a group working to reduce the arrest and incarceration of youth, and her blog is called Prison Culture. Welcome to Counterspin, Maryam Kaba.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we know that media love a story, and not just media. Lots of us use stories to organize ideas. But stories have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And for many, whatever the grand jury decides on Darren Wilson is likely to be the end of the story of Ferguson. And not just the end, but the signifier, the most important fact. Would you talk a little about what an indictment does and does not mean to you?
For many people in this country, the law and the courts equal justice. And so that's the way that you actually get justice for most people. And they see that as incredibly important for accountability and also for symbolic measure. For myself, I'm not invested in a indictment of Wilson, though, again, I'm not opposed to indicting cops who kill people. I'm a prison abolitionist, so I don't support imprisonment in terms of the ways in which we address harm, particularly. But I, you know, I'm fine with the court system. I'm fine with people going to trial and being adjudicated in a court of law. That's important to many. But I think at the bottom for me is that an indictment is not going to shift. It's not going to end police violence. It's not going to shift the culture of impunity for the most part that the police benefit from. It's not going to bring back Mike Brown. It isn't going to end the possibility of another Mike Brown. And so I, you know, in my piece that I wrote on my blog, I was really pointing to the importance of a wholesale societal, economic, political shift and uprooting of oppression in general as being the way that we would be able to end this kind of violence.
Well, one of the heartening things about the activism around Ferguson and around the killing of Mike Brown is what looks like the growing of new activists, the linking of people across generations. It's not lost on them, even as close as they are to this particular story. It doesn't seem to be lost on them that this isn't the beginning or the end.
Absolutely. I agree. I've been heartened, and I've seen just in my own community here in Chicago, so many young people galvanized and activated by this particular moment and this historical moment that we're in. And I see them very much trying to make those linkages between the broader issues that surround police violence and that give rise to police violence. And so I have really been heartened in that point. But I also have to say that because many of these activists are new to activism and are just coming in this moment, you know, you don't want people to lose heart and to focus so much it on particular indictment that that becomes a heartbreaker if it doesn't actually occur and can sometimes quench the revolutionary fervor that some people are feeling. So part of what I was trying to bring to bear in that piece was to say, okay, if an indictment is important to you, good, okay, you know, hold that. But also realize that we're fighting for some things that are much bigger than an indictment, and that a singular indictment is not going to actually change the system. And that's what we are trying to do, is to transform the system.
And it also means don't give up hope as well.
That's exactly right. It's important. Hope is a discipline. You definitely need to keep working on it. you need to keep, you know, focusing. You need to keep remembering every day. You're renewing your hope every single day.
I heard an interview with Maya Shenhua recently. Her new book is called Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. We saw Proposition 47 in California, which reduces penalties for certain nonviolent crimes, meaning many people are eligible for release. We've seen incarceration pushed so powerfully, not least by the media, for decades now as a social response and as a funding source for communities. Do you see that tide turning a little bit?
I'm not in the exuberantly optimistic camp, to be honest with you. I've been doing work around prisons for a very long time. Just yesterday, there was a new study that came out that showed that most states actually project that their prison populations will increase in the next 10 years. So it's kind of this twofold thing that's happening. A lot of rhetoric, a lot of busyness around the concept of decarceration, and yet we just saw that the prison count from the BJS came out not long ago, a couple of months ago, and we saw that the prison population actually increased this year after a four-year decrease. That's because what we're dealing with is talking a lot about instrumental kinds of things. You know, it costs too much money. That's why we need to decarcerate. We haven't had the argument about the moral imperative to actually end prisons, the human cost of prisons, that human beings should not be treated this way, that it's torture. You know, we haven't convinced anybody along those lines yet, right? And so that's why it can fluctuate so easily. In good times, quote unquote, good economic times, you can expect the prison population to increase again because people have not actually taken in the moral argument as to why prisons should not exist and should be abolished.
Yeah, you see it kind of nibbled at. Well, perhaps people under 16 shouldn't be in prison, or perhaps we shouldn't have solitary confinement, but it's not really getting at the core.
Exactly right. We're nibbling around the edges. We're tinkering around the edges. And that's because we're really comfortable with reform. And what reform usually does is reifies the status quo while also giving a head nod to like, okay, yeah, we kind of want to take away, you know, 10% of this, then that means that we've made progress. And what we need is really a revolutionary change, wholesale transformative justice. And that's why Proposition 47 is such a double-edged sword, right? Because it made the case that some people actually deserve to be in prison while saying that people who were nonviolent offenders along these certain lines deserve to be let free, right? So in a way, we kind of cement the fact, we cement the prison by trying to reform it. We actually reify it and make it even stronger. We have to say that everybody deserves to live free and then work from there.
We've been speaking with Maryam Kaba. You can find her recent piece, Indicting a System, Not a Man, on the blog Prison Culture. Thank you very much, Maryam Kaba, for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
The midterm election results would seem to tell us that Barack Obama is entering the lame duck phase of his presidency, but then came the announcement of a greenhouse gas deal with China, which was labeled a groundbreaking move to cut emissions in both countries. It made some Republicans very mad, but people who think we have to take bold action to avert a climate catastrophe should see this as good news, right? Joining us now is Daphne Weisham. She is a climate policy fellow at the Center for Sustainable Economy. Welcome back to the show, Daphne Weisham.
Thanks for having me.
Now, if you read the press about this, it was almost all good news. The Washington Post editorial page, a landmark climate deal. The New York Times, a major breakthrough on climate change. Columnist Paul Krugman at the time says it is, in fact, a big deal. Back at the Post, under the headline, What the Planet Needed, Eugene Robinson calls it a stunning announcement and warned us to pay no attention to the yes, but chorus. Well, you might fall into that category. Let's pay attention to the argument. What's not to like about this U.S.-China climate deal?
Well, let's keep in mind who is included in the yes, but chorus, and that would include the International Energy Agency, who has said essentially, despite these pledges that the U.S. and China have made, that we are on track to a 3.6 Celsius rise in global temperatures, which is almost 7 degrees Fahrenheit. So that far exceeds where we need to go. We are hoping to keep our rise in temperatures below 2 degrees Celsius by 2100. On the one hand, yes, of course, it's welcome news that this logjam in the negotiations that has been going on for several decades, with the U.S. claiming that it won't do anything until China and India and other big emitters go first, that has been broken by China's commitment to cap its emissions at 2030. But the devil is, of course, in the details. One of the details that is quite alarming is that China has no plan, no firm plan to peak its emissions before 2030. The scientific community suggests that 2020 should be the year that China focuses on for its peak. Another area of concern is that, of course, this is a non-binding agreement between the U.S. and China, but it's a good first start. China has said that they would like to have a target of 20% of their energy portfolio from non-fossil energy resources, which can include large hydro and nuclear power as well as solar and wind. But if you look at the agreement, solar and wind really aren't given a major emphasis. Now, 20% of China's current energy portfolio is equivalent to the entire U.S. electrical grid. So this is not an insignificant amount that China is planning to ramp up in terms of non-fossil energy, but it could go a variety of different directions. I've heard from people that are tracking the nuclear issue that there's no way that China could invest that much in nuclear power. It's just not feasible in the next 15 years. However, that is an area of concern in the aftermath of the Fukushima meltdown, that China may be pursuing an increase in nuclear power.
Well, we've dealt with the Chinese side of this agreement. What will it mean for the United States?
It turns out the U.S. commitments that President Obama has made of 26 to 28% below 2005 levels by 2025 are actually less ambitious than what was on the table in Copenhagen. For both countries, these targets are essentially not very ambitious. That essentially represent what was being planned anyway. So the onus is now on us being civil society and climate activists, to keep the pressure on the top two global emitters, U.S. and China, which represent over 40% of all greenhouse gas emissions, and then hopefully to bring in other countries as well, including India, and figure out a way to ramp down our emissions long before 2030.
I do get the sense that diminished expectations play a role here. Paul Krugman, for instance, thinks this is a good first step. But then in the same column, he also wrote that if the deal were to work exactly as stated, the planet would experience a highly damaging rise in temperatures. If that is true, then it's hard to see what there is to get excited about here. Is the enthusiasm we're seeing simply a matter of this is as good as we can get politically right now, so it's better than nothing?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have set our expectations very low, both in this country and internationally, and that's in large part due to a very successful campaign by the fossil fuel industry to push back against any sort of regulation and to pit the developed countries against the developing countries. I remember back in 1997 when a group calling itself the Global Climate Coalition, which was in fact a front group for the fossil fuel industry, was putting out ads in newspapers saying it's not a fair deal, it's not a global deal, and making clear that this was an issue that was pitting North against South, and trying to encourage a lack of action in the U.S. as a result. So now we've at least gotten to the point where it's harder for the climate obstructionists to push this argument, which is, why should we stop emitting greenhouse gas emissions if China won't? So that's off the table. We do need to push back against this meme that suggests, you know, that China is unreliable, and that's the latest argument I've been hearing from the climate deniers, is that there's no way we should buy into this. Of course, the U.S. has been less than reliable every step of the way until very recently. But in terms of the ambition of the agreement, absolutely, it's nowhere near what the science requires. So we need to push harder.
And finally, the New York Times reported on this deal as being part of Obama's vision for what they refer to as a cornerstone of his legacy. If an arrangement like this is perhaps a good step but insufficient, what would an adequate legacy-building approach to dealing with the climate catastrophe actually look like?
Well, let's keep in mind that even with this agreement where Obama has committed to 26 to 28% below 2005 levels by 2025, that has nothing to do with, again, with what the science requires. Most of the benchmarks are focused on 1990 levels, not 2005. And B, this kicks the can down the road to the next administration. He is putting in motion with the EPA rules restricting greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired power plants, a significant drop in greenhouse gas emissions from coal. However, he is simultaneously ramping up fracking, as we know, and he has not yet taken a position, although it's looking more hopeful that he is going to veto any Keystone XL pipeline bill that comes to his desk. So I think what we really would like to see in the next 2 years is Obama continuing to hold firm against climate denialists in the Senate and the fossil fuel industry that has clearly got a stranglehold on the U.S. Congress, and continuing to push forward not just the EPA regs on emissions, but also fly ash and a variety of other energy efficiency guidelines that he's been pushing, and continue to ramp up investments in clean, renewable energy.
We've been speaking with Daphne Wysham. She's a climate policy fellow at the Center for Sustainable Economy. You can find them at sustainable-economy.org. Thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin, Daphne Wysham.
You're welcome.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you'd like more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.